It's Tuesday, the 12th of August, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, in Flagstaff, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Trump orders takeover of D.C. police, Putin harbors high hopes for talks in Alaska, and NVIDIA CEO pays to ply China trade. That first headline, Trump orders takeover of D.C. police, president calls up guard, citing fight against crime, hence he'll act in other cities. Home Rule Act permits a takeover under emergency conditions. This article is by Tarini Party, Meredith McGraw, and Laura Seligman. Washington. President Trump deployed National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. and placed the city's police department under federal control, launching an unprecedented effort to take charge of the nation's capital. This is Liberation Day in D.C., and we're going to take our capital back, Trump said during a news conference at the White House, where he was flanked by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and other senior administration officials. Trump deployed about 800 D.C. National Guard troops to the city and said he would consider calling in active duty military troops if needed. He also suggested he might attempt to exert more federal control over other U.S. cities, mentioning Baltimore, New York, and Oakland, California. The president compared the homicide rate in Washington with capitals around the world, including Bogota, Colombia. Violent crime in the city was down 35% last year from 2023, Justice Department data show, the lowest in more than 30 years. The data showed a decline in homicides, robberies, armed carjackings, and assaults with a dangerous weapon. Crime remains a problem in the city, according to local officials. D.C. has a higher per capita homicide rate than most other major U.S. cities. You want to have safety in the streets. You want to be able to leave your apartment or your house where you live and feel safe in going to the store to buy a newspaper or buy something, and you don't have that now, Trump said, adding he was going to get rid of slums. The president has escalated his attacks on the city in recent days, saying Mayor Muriel Bowser, a Democrat, hadn't done enough to control crime and homelessness. He also increased federal law enforcement's presence in the city, deploying hundreds of federal agents throughout the district, including more than 100 from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, a person familiar with the matter said. The actions by Trump, a Republican, were met with opposition from some local officials who accused Trump of overreaching. Bowser called Trump's decision to exert control over D.C. unsettling and unprecedented, and she raised concerns about the prospect of sending the military into the city. We don't believe it's legal to use the American military against American citizens on American soil, she said during a Monday afternoon news conference, but she said the president has the authority to federalize the police. Eleanor Holmes Norton, a Democrat who is the district's non-voting congressional delegate, said Trump's moves are an historic assault on D.C. home rule and a counterproductive escalatory seizure of D.C.'s resources to use for purposes not supported by D.C. residents. National Guard troops are expected to play a supporting role, helping law enforcement with administrative tasks, logistics, and transportation, Army spokesman Colonel David Butler said. There are no plans to station military police on federal property. Troops won't carry arms, but their weapons will be close by, Butler said. Trump brought up Edward Korestein, who worked for the Department of Government Efficiency and was beaten after an attempted carjacking earlier this month. He previously posted a photo of a bloody Korestein without identifying him on social media. If D.C. doesn't get its act together and quickly, we'll have no choice but to take federal control of the city, the president wrote in the Post. Under the Home Rule Act, which established the district's governing body, Congress has the power to challenge laws passed by the Washington City Council and must approve the budget, although it rarely gets involved. The president can deploy the district's National Guard, but has limited ability to intervene in day-to-day matters. Trump invoked Section 740 of the Home Rule Act, which allows the president to federalize Washington's Metropolitan Police when special conditions of an emergency nature exist. Trump signed an executive order on Monday declaring a crime emergency in the district that requires the use of D.C. police for federal purposes, such as maintaining law and order. Shortly before noon on Monday, the White House notified the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, which has jurisdiction over D.C., about its plans to take over the city's police force, according to a panel spokesman. A White House official said the federal takeover of the city's police is expected to last for 30 days, but the official said that time frame is subject to change. The president said Bondi would oversee the city's police department. Terry Cole, the administrator for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, will serve as interim federal commissioner of the D.C. police, he said. The president said he planned to call on Congress to take action to end cashless bail, which he said contributes to an increase in crime in cities. Illinois, New York, and Washington, D.C. have eliminated or limited the use of cash bail, which proponents say makes the criminal justice system more equitable. Trump has carried over his rhetoric about D.C. from the campaign trail. The Republican Party platform adopted at his nominating convention states that the GOP would reassert greater federal control over Washington, D.C. Trump sent National Guard troops and Marines to Los Angeles in response to protests over deportation operations earlier this year. California officials said the military presence exacerbated tensions in Los Angeles. In 2020, Trump deployed the National Guard to Washington, D.C. amid widespread protests following the killing of George Floyd. In his first term, Trump also sent federal agents to some major cities amid protests, including Portland, Oregon. That's Trump orders takeover of D.C. police. Our next article, Putin Harbors High Hopes for Talks in Alaska, is by Yaroslav Trofimov. Expectations in Russia are running high ahead of Friday's planned summit between Russian leader Vladimir Putin and President Trump. Moscow sees an opening to reset relations with Washington, with Kremlin officials hinting at the potential for deals with the U.S. on infrastructure and energy in the Arctic and beyond, as Russia's state media plays up what it bills as a looming entente between two equal great powers. Neocons and other warmongers won't be smiling when the two leaders meet, senior Putin aide Kirill Dmitriev said. The Putin-Trump dialogue will bring hope, peace, and global security. Though the Ukrainian question has been declared the main item of the agenda, much more important global issues would be raised in Alaska, including ambitious plans for economic and infrastructure cooperation in the Arctic, senior Russian lawmaker Sergei Gavrilov said. Alexander Yakovenko, a former ambassador who headed Russia's Foreign Service Academy until last year, wrote in an op-ed for the state RIA news agency that settling the war in Ukraine, which has been lost by the West a long time ago, has become a secondary issue in relations between the United States and Russia. Nothing more than an obstacle to normalization that we must overcome together. Ever since the summit was announced, Russian media has been replete with stories about special U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff and Dmitriev sharing fried dumplings at a restaurant in the Russian capital and about the site of a future Moscow hotel described as a possible Trump Tower Moscow that the two men visited last week. But when it comes to Ukraine, there's been little indication that Putin intends to make a meaningful compromise. The Russian president's offer, as relayed by Witkoff, is a ceasefire if Kyiv agrees to give up territory, including major urban areas that Russian forces have been unable to capture. Western diplomats and Russian analysts say Putin thinks he's winning on the battlefield and that his original goal of replacing President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine with a puppet regime in Kyiv might finally be within reach now that Washington has stopped paying for Ukrainian weapons. The very fact of the summit with Trump, and in the U.S. no less, is already a win for Putin, helping restore the international standing of man treated as a pariah in much of the West and facing an arrest warrant on war crimes charges from the International Criminal Court in The Hague. He can say, look, you've tried to isolate me, but I'm meeting with the American president while you Europeans have to crawl on your knees and call him daddy, said Sergei Radchenko, a Cold War historian at Johns Hopkins University. The image of standing tall and proud on equal terms with the United States, that's what Russia has always wanted, and that's what's really important to Putin. Trump has let his self-imposed deadline on sanctions against Russia lapse ahead of the summit, a move European diplomats fear signals to Russia that no serious additional U.S. pressure will be placed on the Kremlin, whatever happens with Ukraine. Putin is absolutely convinced, as the general staff continues to tell him, that with a little more pushing, the Ukrainian front will collapse, said Alexandra Prokopenko, a fellow at the Carnegie Russian Eurasia Center and former advisor to Russia's central bank. That doesn't mean Russia will oppose a pause on its own terms, such as a stop to weapon supplies for Ukraine that would make its next round of offensives easier, she said. One possible concession in Alaska, some Moscow-based analyst indicated, would be for Putin to offer a limited ceasefire in the air. Such a move would be in Russia's interest because Ukraine's long-range drone attacks have caused significant damage to Russian oil refineries and military industries, while also disrupting Russian civil aviation. Air attacks could resume once Russia stockpiled enough missiles and drones and repaired the damage. Russian troops this summer have stepped up a ground offensive in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region, aiming to encircle the towns of Pokrovsk and Mironobrod. Meanwhile, protests against attempts to curb Ukrainian anti-corruption authorities have also shown wide discontent with Zelensky. Still, total Russian advances over the past 2 years account for less than 1% of Ukrainian territory. No strategic breakthroughs have been achieved, and the much-heralded Russian offensive this year on the northern region of Sumy has collapsed with high losses. The Russian proposal ahead of the Alaska summit, as relayed by Witkoff to European leaders and Ukraine, calls for Kyiv to surrender to Russia the heavily fortified northern part of the Donetsk region in exchange for a ceasefire. That's an area larger than the entire West Bank, with big industrial cities. Zelensky has rejected the demand, saying he won't give away Ukrainian land, and pointing to Russia's long history of violating ceasefires and diplomatic agreements. European leaders back Kyiv, saying that any territorial concessions must be reciprocal and accompanied by security guarantees. Trump said Monday that his meeting with Putin is meant to feel out whether a peace deal was possible. Trump threatened to abandon the negotiations if he sensed no agreement could be made. He said that he'll seek a Russian withdrawal from some occupied parts of Ukraine. What the Russian public has been told to expect is a Ukrainian surrender rather than a ceasefire, let alone a Russian withdrawal. The special military operation is a zero-sum game, and it can only be concluded with total victory, Kirev Fedorov, a Russian military analyst, wrote on Telegram. Both the Zelensky folks and the Kremlin understand that. While Trump is a 1990s businessman in a president's chair, so he just keeps imagining deals. And that was Putin harbors high hopes for talks in Alaska. Next article by Lingling Wei, Raphael Huang, and Amrith Ramkumar. NVIDIA CEO pays to ply China trade. Jensen Huang tried diplomacy for Trump's permission to sell chips. It wasn't enough. Jensen Huang, chief executive of California-based chip designer NVIDIA, worked for months behind the scenes in Washington and Beijing to protect tens of billions of dollars in future NVIDIA sales from the heated U.S.-China trade rivalry. Huang told President Trump that restrictions on U.S. chip sales to China would backfire by pushing Chinese technology champions to achieve self-reliance. He advised the president to keep China hooked on American tech. As a sweetener, Huang said, the company would invest as much as $500 billion in the U.S. Huang's argument, along with the $500 billion offer from the world's most valuable company, appeared to seal the deal. The Trump administration decided last month to allow China to buy NVIDIA's H2O artificial intelligence chip, a surprising reversal that came shortly after Huang met with Trump. NVIDIA had developed the H2O to comply with past export restrictions as a less powerful chip specially designed for China. The news sent NVIDIA's stock up 4%, pushing its market capitalization further above the record $4 trillion mark. Beijing reciprocated by allowing a $35 billion deal involving U.S. chip software makers that it had held up for about a year. In a previously unreported development, Chinese officials also froze an inquiry into an already completed NVIDIA deal. With both moves, China's leader hoped Huang would keep lobbying Washington for loosened export controls. There was one last hitch. At a meeting with Huang in the White House last week, Trump made one more demand: that NVIDIA give the federal government 20% of its chip sales to China in exchange for issuing the export licenses. "If I'm going to do that, I want you to pay us something," Trump said, recounting the exchange at a news conference Monday. The unusual pay-to-play proposal, which hadn't been vetted by White House tech policy staff before Trump offered it, is expected to face legal and security questions. Huang, facing a choice of paying for long-term access to a market vital to his company or walking away, countered with 15%. He charmed Trump at the meeting, drawing the president a diagram showing how tariffs would be counterproductive for his goal of increasing U.S. chip production, and signed it. After the meeting, Trump said he would exempt tech companies that invest in the U.S. from roughly 100% tariffs on semiconductor imports. The Trump administration's decision to allow China access to the H2O chip appears a watershed moment in U.S. policy. In Trump's first term, as well as through President Biden's, the prevailing trend was generally tougher control on tech sales to China. National security concerns often received greater weight in the past than business interests. Many attribute the potential shift to Huang's lobbying effort. The CEO has lavished praise on Trump and China, and the admiration is mutual. On a July visit to Beijing, Huang hailed Chinese technological progress. Privately, a lieutenant to Chinese leader Xi Jinping told Huang that Beijing appreciated how NVIDIA was contributing to the world's AI advances. At a Washington AI summit in late July, Trump said he'd looked at breaking up NVIDIA because of its dominant market share. But that was before he got to know Huang and the industry. "What a job you've done," Trump told Huang, who was seated in the front row. "America's unique advantage that no country could possibly have is President Trump," Huang said at the summit. As Elon Musk learned, winners in the Washington influence competition attract opponents. Lawmakers in both parties have challenged Huang, saying that if China gets NVIDIA chips, China's AI companies could benefit, potentially aiding its military. These criticisms are misguided and inconsistent with the administration's AI action plan, an NVIDIA spokesman said. "The H2O will not enhance anyone's military capabilities, but will help America win the support of developers worldwide." This account is based on interviews with current and former officials in both countries, people close to and working for NVIDIA, as well as those familiar with Huang and his lobbying efforts. President Trump regularly talks to business leaders like Jensen Huang, who are making historic investments in American manufacturing, White House spokesman Kush Desai said. "The only special interest guiding the president's decision-making is the best interest of the American people." Into the fray. For years, Huang avoided the rough-and-tumble world of Washington politics, referring to schmooze with the video gamers who were the original customers for his chips. The 62-year-old billionaire, a libertarian at heart, resisted the lobbying game, delegating the task to his lieutenants. As NVIDIA's chips became one of the world's most strategic commodities because of their role in AI, Washington remained a no-man's land for this Silicon Valley company. Huang didn't visit the White House or engage lawmakers meaningfully until 2023, when he joined the chief executives of Intel and Qualcomm to lobby against new curbs on tech sales to China by the Biden administration. Restrictions on chip exports to many countries friendly with the U.S. announced in the final days of Biden's term escalated the threat. When Trump won a second term, Huang faced an administration stacked with China hawks and the prospect of even tighter U.S. controls on tech exports. The company bashed the Biden administration's restrictions and warned the rules would benefit such Chinese competitors as NVIDIA rival Huawei. NVIDIA hired former Trump National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, co-founder of a consulting firm. O'Brien helped communicate a sense of urgency regarding breakthroughs from DeepSeek and other Chinese AI companies, as well as chip advances by Huawei. Former Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who chairs an institute that promotes innovation, also carried the message. In early April, when the White House was preparing to cut off H2O sales, Huang attended a $1 million ahead dinner with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. He told the president that selling the chip in China wasn't a threat to national security. Huang also dangled an incentive, a promise to invest half as much as $500 billion worth of AI infrastructure and supercomputers in the U.S. Huang thought he had made a persuasive case, and Trump announced the $500 billion investment. After the dinner, a powerful rival intervened with a counterargument. Musk, still close to Trump at the time, had his own AI ambitions to consider. He told Trump that any advanced chip in Chinese hands threatened U.S. tech supremacy. That view, combined with opposition from national security-minded officials, persuaded Trump to impose the restriction Huang had tried to stop. Huang had been outmaneuvered and didn't enjoy losing, especially when, as he later said, $15 billion in sales were at stake. Persuasive pitch. In early May, Huang spent about 2 hours with members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee in a private discussion about the threat of Huawei and Chinese competitors and the need for NVIDIA to have access to Chinese talent. Later that month, the Trump administration said it was getting rid of the Biden rule limiting chip sales to many friendly countries after pushback from Huang and other industry executives. Huang found a powerful ally at the White House, the so-called AI czar, David Sachs. He shared the fear of ceding the advanced chip market to Chinese rivals. The two men drew the support of Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, who oversees export controls and is well acquainted with tech companies from his former career as a Wall Street dealmaker. All three championed a deal to send NVIDIA chips to the United Arab Emirates in mid-May. They later went to see Trump for an unannounced meeting at the White House on July the 10th. Huang told the president that tight restrictions on NVIDIA would just give Huawei a leg up in the AI race. President really want to let China get all the spoils and turn American champions like NVIDIA into losers? Trump made his decision, which was announced days later when Huang was in Beijing. China could have the H2O chips as part of a broader trade detente. China hawks who counted on Trump's support were appalled. Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee, led by Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, wrote to Lutnick expressing grave concern with the administration's abrupt and inexplicable decision. They said China's commercial AI advances, helped by NVIDIA, were quickly translating into a national security advantage for the People's Liberation Army. NVIDIA has played down concerns about large numbers of chips being diverted to China's military or other adversaries. Beijing would consider such a move risky because Washington could cut off access at any time, according to Huang. They simply can't rely on it, he said in a TV interview in July. Magic Taylor. Winning in Washington was only half the battle. NVIDIA's market share in China fell to 50% from 95% over the past 4 years under U.S. restrictions, Huang said in May. He visited China at least 3 times this year to reassure Chinese tech executives and government officials that NVIDIA was committed to the market. The trips came when many U.S. executives shunned visits to Beijing or even being seen with Chinese tech titans. Huang has met with top executives of Chinese cloud computing leader Alibaba, smartphone and automaker Xiaomi, and OpenAI challenger MiniMax. People in China's tech industry said they appreciated Huang's efforts to modify his chips so they could be sold in China. Engineers there nicknamed him Magic Taylor for his skill in designing chips to thread the needle of U.S. regulations. Knowing the importance of Chinese markets to NVIDIA, Beijing increased pressure on the company. China's cybersecurity regulator recently summoned NVIDIA representatives to discuss alleged security risks of the H2O chips, citing comments by U.S. lawmakers about the need for a bill to require tracking capabilities for advanced chips sold abroad. Huang and others in the industry have lobbied against the bill, which could face more opposition if it gains traction. The White House has said it wants to study chip tracking, but hasn't weighed in on the legislation specifically. NVIDIA denied the H2O chip represented such security risks to Beijing. While the H2O can't be used for creating large AI models, such as the ones powering ChatGPT and other chatbots, engineers say the chip is still good at inference, the ability of AI programs to tap their training to answer user questions. Since early this year, the H2O chip has played a critical role in filling sky-high demand for AI applications using open-source models such as Chinese-developed DeepSeek and Alibaba's Qwen, especially since Chinese chipmakers have had trouble stepping up production capacity. Chinese engineers say companies often get hooked on NVIDIA's software, making them reluctant to switch to other companies. That's setting the stage for a battle over NVIDIA's next-generation chip that Huang is crafting for China. The company frames the new chip as another stripped-down variant, but it is based on the Blackwell architecture, which is NVIDIA's most advanced on the market. NVIDIA has begun sending samples to Chinese clients for testing. I hope to get more advanced chips into China than H2O, the CEO said during his visit to Beijing. On Monday, Trump said he was comfortable allowing H2O exports because the U.S. has much better chips. The most powerful NVIDIA products wouldn't be approved for export unless they were modified for lower performance, he said. Regarding the potential for Huang seeking to export versions of NVIDIA's new chips to China, Trump said, "I think he's coming to see me again about that." And that's NVIDIA CEO pays to ply China trade. You're listening to The Wall Street Journal here on the Sun Sounds of Arizona. Remember, you can listen to The Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And then you can also listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Well, let's turn now to business and finance, and we have these headlines. Paramount UFC in $7.7 billion deal. Antidote to aluminum tariff is in the trash. And Ford plans low-cost EV models as it eyes China rivals. That first headline, Paramount UFC in $7.7 billion deal, unit newly bought by Skydance wins rights to stream broadcast fights for 7 years. This is by Joe Flint. Skydance's Paramount has struck a 7-year, $7.7 billion deal with TKO Group for exclusive media rights for all Ultimate Fighting Championship matches in the U.S. starting next year, the company said. Under the terms, the Paramount Plus streaming service will carry UFC's slate of 13 marquee events and will also have rights to 30 fight nights. In addition, Paramount can simulcast some fights on its sister broadcast network, CBS, on Saturday nights. The pact gives TKO's UFC a significant pay increase over the organization's current agreement with Disney's ESPN. Paramount is paying an average of $1.1 billion a year, while Disney's deal was valued at $550 million annually. The jump in fees shows the popularity of the mixed martial arts sport. The deal is the latest between a sports organization and media company seeking live events to stream and broadcast, a valuable attraction for subscribers. The deal also moves UFC away from the pay-per-view model and was an element of the ESPN Accord. The agreement comes days after Skydance closed on its acquisition of Paramount though talks between Paramount and UFC preceded the acquisition. Now everyone knows why I was at so many UFC events, Paramount Chairman and Chief Executive David Ellison joked in an interview. Ellison attended a UFC fight that President Trump was also at in April in Miami, and last year went to a bout at the Sphere in Las Vegas. TKO President and Chief Operating Officer Mark Shapiro said the company was attracted to the opportunity to show UFC on CBS, along with Paramount's willingness to abandon pay-per-view. If we can get with a partner that's going to put us front and center and not charge extra to get our most premium content, that is a game-changer, Shapiro said. Content such as UFC, which is year-round, is seen as crucial for streamers such as Paramount Plus in their fight to reduce subscriber churn. We believe it will meaningfully drive engagement, revenue growth, and subscription acquisitions, Ellison said. Paramount indicated it also intends to pursue international rights for UFC content that becomes available in the coming years. Ellison said he hopes the deal signals to the industry and Paramount that you can't cut to grow, and the company will meaningfully invest in content that can boost its platforms. Talks with Paramount began in earnest in early June after TKO's exclusive negotiating window with ESPN expired. There were other bidders as well, both parties said. Netflix was at one point in the hunt for UFC rights, people familiar with the matter said. ESPN last week signed a deal for premium content from TKO's World Wrestling Entertainment, valued at $1.6 billion over 5 years, which might help fill some of the void from losing UFC. An ESPN spokesman said it appreciated its UFC collaboration and is looking forward to starting its deal with WWE next year. For TKO, the deals with Paramount and ESPN, along with last year's 10-year pact with Netflix for WWE's Raw, valued at $5 billion, has the nearly two-year-old company feeling like it's on a winning streak. There are a lot of people who poo-pooed us when we bought the UFC and merged with WWE. We've made these deals in a very competitive environment, and they've come out extremely well, said TKO Executive Chairman and CEO Ari Emanuel. And that's Paramount UFC in $7.7 billion deal. Our next article by Ryan Ditzember. Antidote to aluminum tariff is in the trash. Cassopolis, Michigan. The way around President Trump's 50% tariff on imported aluminum might be sitting in your garbage. But Americans will have to do a lot more recycling, metal executives and analysts say, for the U.S. to break its reliance on imported aluminum. Even with such a high trade barrier, they give long odds to a domestic smelting revival. Recycling is the answer, said Duncan Pitchford, who leads Norsk Hydro's upstream aluminum business in the U.S. The metal is already here. U.S. primary aluminum production has dwindled over the past 25 years, yet facilities like Hydro's two-year-old plant in southwest Michigan have made the country a leading producer of secondary aluminum from scrap, feeding metal to brewers, builders, and automakers that are now burdened by the 50% import tax. Building an aluminum smelter to make primary aluminum from refined bauxite would take several years and billions of dollars, never mind continuing electricity consumption that can rival that of a major U.S. city. Aluminum recycling plants can be built faster and cheaper, roughly 2 years and $150 million in the case of the Cassopolis plant. And since recycling facilities melt aluminum rather than cause a chemical reaction to create it, they consume about 5% of the energy needed for primary production, Pitchford said. If the 14 remelt projects announced since 2022 are built and Americans significantly improve their recycling habits, the U.S. could reduce aluminum imports by as much as half, according to the Aluminum Association. More than $1 billion of beverage cans were dumped in the U.S. landfills just last year, the trade group estimates. By weight, that was similar to all the primary aluminum produced by U.S. smelters. A lack of sorting operations means that a lot of the aluminum in junked cars, demolition debris, and old electronics winds up in landfills. If we get that back, it will be recycled, said Aluminum Association's Matt Meehan. The U.S. sends scrap abroad, exporting about 2.4 million metric tons of mostly lower-grade post-consumer aluminum last year. Recycling more of it stateside would be less expensive than to continuing to fill the supply gap with imports now that there's a 50% tariff. The import tax has lifted U.S. aluminum prices to a record relative to the global price set in London's trading pits. The benchmark Midwest premium has about tripled this year, reaching 72 cents a pound in August, according to S&P Global Commodity Insights. U.S. buyers pay that on top of the London Metal Exchange price, which was recently $1.18 a pound. The added cost is walloping beverage companies and manufacturers. Brewer Molson Coors told investors this month that it expected the greater premium to add $40 million to $55 million to its expenses this year. Ford Motor said $800 million of tariffs on imported parts, steel, and aluminum helped wipe out its profit last quarter, and that it expects a $2 billion hit to its annual earnings. Automakers and other big aluminum users have yet to raise prices much in response. Analysts say it's a matter of time before the stockpiles of metal that arrived in the U.S. ahead of the June increase are depleted and companies start passing on higher aluminum costs. Without any relaxation of the tariffs, the situation for U.S. consumers may deteriorate in the second half of the year, said Karen Norton, principal analyst at S&P Global. In his first term, Trump set a 10% tariff on aluminum imports. His aim was to block cheap foreign aluminum so that domestic producers could take back market share and be available to meet the demand from the military and infrastructure projects. Upon returning to the White House, he raised the tariff to 25% and eliminated exemptions that were given to big suppliers, including Mexico and Canada. Trump doubled the levy in June. At 25%, they can sort of get over that fence, he said at a rally near Pittsburgh when he unveiled a higher tariff. At 50%, they can no longer get over the fence. The U.S. once dominated the aluminum business. The first commercial batch was made in Pittsburgh in 1888 by the company that became Alcoa. The U.S. remained the world's top producer through 2000. Smelters started closing around then, squeezed by cheaper Chinese and Russian exports and the rising energy costs. Electricity accounts for about 40% of the cost of making primary aluminum. Domestic smelters for decades were provided low-price hydropower from federal utilities, the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Northwest's Bonneville Power Administration. When those arrangements ended, smelters had to start paying market rates. Only four of the 24 smelters operating in 2000 are still running. U.S. manufacturers came to rely on aluminum from Canada, where Quebec's cheap hydropower fuel smelters owned by Alcoa, Hydro, and others. The tariff has Canadian smelters rerouting their output, while scrap, which isn't subject to Trump's tariff, is being shipped from Europe and piling up in the U.S. About 15 million pounds of scrap arrive each month at Hydro's Michigan plant, mostly by truck. The Norwegian aluminum producer built its third U.S. recycling plant between big scrap markets in Chicago and Detroit. Cassopolis is in the middle of the largest concentration of aluminum extruders in the U.S., Pitchford said. The extruders that make parts for Michigan's automakers and Indiana's RV manufacturers are the plant's main customers, as well as diligent recyclers returning their scrap to be melted into the next batch of malleable billets. Other trucks arrive in Cassopolis full of shredded cars, old window and door frames, and overhead electrical wire. The plant doesn't recycle cans, which go to facilities that specialize in turning the two alloys and beverage containers into new cans. Cassopolis specializes in producing automotive crash alloys. Among its state-of-the-art features is a de-lacquering furnace, which burns off impurities like paint, labels, and dirt, and enables the plant to recycle lower-grade scrap than most. A lot of the material comes through a sorting hub near Grand Rapids where Hydro uses laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy technology to mechanically separate scrap by alloy. In Southeast Asia, where a lot of exported scrap is sent, different types of aluminum are separated by hand. "We can't do that in the U.S., Pitchford said. "We need hundreds of these machines around the country if we're going to meaningfully reduce scrap exports." And that's Antidote to Aluminum Tariff is in the trash. Turn now to an article by Paolo Trevisani. Rising supply creates a muni bond moment. A steady increase in municipal bond supply, coupled with the survival of their tax benefit in President Trump's spending bill, is making the securities more attractive, even as key sectors such as healthcare and education stand to lose. Municipal bond investors are in a sweet spot. Prices have come down mainly due to historically high issuance, and that pushes up the interest the securities pay. For most of this year, markets worried that the One Big Beautiful Bill Act would curtail muni's tax exemption benefit, but intense lobbying managed to keep that from happening. The combination represents an opportunity for investors to add some of the safest fixed income securities to their portfolios while expecting unusually high tax-free returns. What is unclear is how long this will last. "There's a lot of reasons to be excited about munis at the moment," said Jason Appleson, head of the municipal bond team at PGIM Fixed Income. "A window of opportunity is open. Valuations are cheap," Appleson said, while warning we're seeing the first signs of normalization, and when normalization occurs, that's when the trade disappears. High-quality munis yielded as much as 4.74% in April by the ICE U.S. Muni AAA 30-year gauge. They're now at 4.56%, still high by historical standards. The 200-day moving average is 4.14%. The higher-than-average yield means bond prices are lower than usual. A flood of new bonds could explain it. Issuance last year hit an historic high of $513.6 billion, according to the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. This year is running even hotter. As of July, issuance was 18% faster than a year earlier, SIFMA said. Weekly flows into municipal bonds funds have decreased since April but remain mostly positive through July, indicating somewhat steady demand, according to LSEG data. Experts believe issuance ballooned in great part out of fear that lawmakers would reduce the municipal bonds tax exemption in order to open room in the budget for Trump's tax cuts and other spending. With that risk in the rearview mirror and given that interest rate cuts by the Federal Reserve are likely imminent, the window to secure fat returns could be closing. As long as you're willing to not stay short and go out a little bit longer maturity-wise, now is the time to lock in these higher rates, said Jennifer Johnston, Director of Municipal Bond Research at Franklin Templeton. There are some sectors and jurisdictions that are likely to be hurt by the provisions included in the spending bill. States are expected to shoulder a larger share of education and healthcare costs, straining local budgets. As the feds pull back on education or funding scientific research or supporting healthcare, it falls to the states to fill the gap, said Matt Fabian, a partner at Municipal Market Analytics. That could support relatively high yields while threatening issuers' credit profile. Fabian said that, though counterintuitive, it may be easier for high-tax states to raise their taxes even higher than for lower-tax states to increase their rates. Residents there are comfortable paying higher taxes, he said. Hospitals top the list of potential victims of the new legislation, and this is a sector that some portfolio managers want to avoid. Many hospitals get most of their revenues from Medicaid and now face budget pressures as funds for the federal program are cut, analysts say. It's a negative for hospitals that rely on Medicaid dollar spending, said Shannon Reinhart, senior municipal portfolio manager at Columbia Threadneedle Investments. The hit will be harder in rural areas where hospitals are already struggling, Reinhart said. Education is also expected to suffer from a reduction in federal transfers. But that goes beyond the big beautiful bill and includes Trump's attacks on colleges that the administration deems misaligned with its policies. If we can get the education headlines out of the front page of the paper every day, I think that would be constructive to our market, Reinhart said. Another wonkier tailwind for munis, Appleson of PGIM Fixed Income said, is the steepness of the yield curve, referring to how much higher long-term yields are relative to shorter-term ones. He said the curve for munis is steepening faster than that for treasuries. That means investors willing to trade bonds before maturity can expect a beefy profit. So, not only did I get my 5% coupon here, I also got an extra dollar's worth on my bond, he said. 4.56%, the yield on high-quality munis, well above the 200-day moving average of 4.14%. And that's rising supply creates a muni bond moment. A final item from the front page of Business and Finance, rare earth magnet firm draws funds in push to counter China. This is by Hana Miao. Startup Vulcan Elements said it raised $65 million in a new funding round to increase production of the rare earth magnets crucial to everything from drones to electric vehicles. The funding signals the growing push to build up an industry in the U.S. and reduce dependence on China. North Carolina-based Vulcan was valued at around $250 million in the funding round led by Brad Gerstner's Altimeter Capital, a tech-focused investment firm that's backed companies such as OpenAI and Uber Technologies. Gerstner also led efforts to create Trump accounts, the $1,000 government-funded investment accounts for children that recently became law. One investment management run by former SoftBank Bank financier Rajiv Misra is also an investor. Vulcan chief executive John Maslin, a former Navy officer, co-founded the company in 2023 as a student at Harvard Business School. He was concerned that China controls around 90% of the world's supply of rare earth magnets. When you talked about rare earth magnets a couple of years ago, they would look at you like you're insane, Maslin said. People actually understand the strategic importance of onshoring this now. Vulcan, which said it previously raised about $10 million in seed funding, opened a pilot manufacturing facility this March in Durham, North Carolina, and has made initial magnets for military and commercial clients. Vulcan says it doesn't use any material, equipment, or software from China, only from the U.S. and its allies. Maslin said the new funding would go to building a large-scale facility that could produce hundreds of metric tons of magnets annually within a couple of years and thousands by the end of this decade. Rare earth magnets have become a flashpoint in U.S.-China trade tensions. In April, Beijing began requiring licenses for exports of certain rare earth metals and related products, slowing exports to a trickle. Automotive, electronics, and defense companies in the U.S. and around the world struggled to get supplies. Rare earth magnet exports from China have recovered a bit after negotiations between the U.S. and China, but flows are well below last year's levels and remain restricted for Western defense companies. To counter China's dominance, the Pentagon is making a multi-million-dollar commitment to America's biggest rare earth mining company, MP Metals. The Defense Department will take a 15% stake in the company, purchase its products, and guarantee a price floor. That's rare earth magnet firm draws funds and push to counter China. Well, let's move on to Heard on the Street, and we have this article, New Buy the Dip Investors Prop Up Market. This is by Gunjan Banerjee. Some were told to fear the crash and instead learn to love the drop. You can't keep everyday investors down for long, at least not in this market. When markets swooned this spring in the face of tariff turmoil, individual investors jumped in to buy the dip. They helped propel a rebound in stocks to records and even resurrected meme trades. For many Wall Street pros, this is another sign of froth at a time when stocks, especially the biggest tech names, are historically expensive. The meme stock trades are rekindling memories of the dot-com boom. But the resilience of individual investors may signal something more than just misplaced optimism. Their willingness to stick with stocks may be more enduring than many veterans realize. That, in turn, may help temper any eventual reversion to the mean for high-flying stocks. Why would this be more than a passing trend? For one, there's been a generational change among investors. Fewer remember calamities such as the dot-com downturn or even the financial crisis. Instead, the current crop of young investors have known mostly blue skies since they opened their first brokerage accounts. They came of age during a time of super low interest rates when markets moved only higher over time. Striking gold during their early investing years emboldened many to take bigger risks, and it encouraged them to hold on during moments of tumult. The Federal Reserve's rate increases in 2022 tested this tendency to buy the dip when the S&P 500 slid 19%, its worst loss since 2008. But many investors stuck around. U.S. stock, mutual, and exchange-traded funds, which are typically tapped by households in trying times, recorded $27 billion of net inflows that year, according to EPFR data. They were quickly rewarded. The drop was followed by the best 2 years for the S&P 500 in a quarter century. More recently, markets tumbled at the start of August because of disappointing jobs data, but they quickly regained their footing. Likewise, when the S&P 500 dropped around 5% for two consecutive sessions after President Trump's Liberation Day in April, individual investors bought record amounts, according to J.P. Morgan. U.S. equity and mutual funds recorded $31 billion of inflows the week ending April 9th, which included the stomach-churning swings after Liberation Day, according to EPFR. Unlike the younger cohort of investors, older millennials and generations prior navigated darker times and longer downturns. Those were tougher to stomach. Take the financial crisis. Investors yanked almost $50 billion from U.S. equity funds in 2008 and continued pulling money for four consecutive years, even after stocks bottomed in March 2009, according to EPFR data. Those who sold missed out on the beginning of the longest bull market since the S&P 500's inception. Meanwhile, after the dot-com bubble popped, the S&P 500 didn't claim a new high for about 7 years. Today, those who have waded into the stock market and stayed invested have watched their portfolios swell. The S&P 500 has become a real-time barometer of many Americans' rising wealth, outperforming other assets like houses or bonds. There were 537,000 401k millionaires at the brokerage Fidelity as of the end of 2024, a record. And stocks are more intertwined with many Americans' finances than ever. Stocks as a percentage of household financial assets surged to 36% in the first quarter, the highest level in records going back to the 1950s, according to Ed Clissold, chief U.S. strategist at Ned Davis Research. It emboldens people because they've been successful, said Jim Paulson, a veteran market watcher and former chief investment strategist at Luthold Group. You kind of start feeling like, this is the deal. I can stomach pullbacks. This has occurred at a time of a wider societal shift. Trading and betting has morphed into entertainment for many Americans. Group chats pop with comments from friends on sports, hot stocks, and memes. Everyone seems to know someone who made millions overnight in cryptocurrencies. Changed attitudes toward gambling have coincided with tech advances that have made it easier and cheaper to trade a variety of assets. Some brokerages have sought to gamify investing, creating the look and feel of a casino within their apps. At the same time, they also offer high-octane trades on things such as options and prediction markets. That's kept individual investors engaged, and they loom large in the market. The share of total options activity that stems from these individual traders recently hovered around 20%, even higher than the peak during 2021's meme mania, according to JP Morgan data. They made up around a fifth of trading volume in the stock market, slightly below the 2021 high, but around double the figure in 2010, according to Jefferies. Of course, every bull market ends, and the higher that valuations are at that point, the more jarring the fall can be. But if there's been a meaningful change in investor psychology, there could be an underappreciated cushion that limits the damage. Today's new bullish investors might function like short sellers did previously, stepping in to buy when everyone else was selling. Charles Schwab recently surveyed its customers and found that around 80% said they plan to buy if markets grow volatile in coming months. The impulse to stay invested might be more powerful and durable than many in markets appreciate. And that's new buy-the-dip investors prop up market. Next from Heard on the Street, we have what a lagging tech bet tells us. It was a more innocent time. In 2006, we were all walking around with BlackBerries and thought that was pretty cool. Google would buy something called YouTube, a microblogging service called Twitter made its debut. 22-year-old Mark Zuckerberg rejected a $1 billion offer from Yahoo to buy his startup, Facebook, and Steve Jobs was preparing to take the wraps off something he called the iPhone. Also launched that year, an exchange-traded fund from Invesco that tracked the S&P 500 technology sector but weighted its stocks equally instead of by size. Equal weighting has been a way for investors to potentially earn more in the long run because of inefficiencies in traditional stock indexes. Since January 2000, $10,000 invested in an S&P index fund has turned into $44,000, but the same stocks equally weighted grew to $65,000. Invesco's tech ETF has done even better, but is a relative disappointment. Over a span when any idiot could beat the market by going all in on tech stocks, and many did, it has lagged behind a leading S&P 500 tech index by 40 percentage points from launch through Friday's close. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for on this article by Spencer Jacob, What a Lagging Tech Bet Tells Us. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining us for this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming at a time of your choosing or as it streams by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet, or streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo.